So, David.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for waiting so long. I'll be short and almost sweet. Very briefly about the accent. I'm a Welsh boomerang. My family immigrated from Wales at the end of the last century. I moved to the States. Long, complicated tale. I was born in Los Angeles, and now I live 10 miles from where my family started, in Cardiff. The second thing I would make, and this is a hint more than anything else, is in the midst of the things I will talk about, Brexit included, I cannot tell you how important Ireland and this city are to us in Cardiff Bay. You are the one demonstration we need that should push come to shove, we can become masters of our own fate, as you have. And as you're unique in the Celtic fringe, don't forget that your importance to us all, who are still part of something else. So it's important, especially on this, the 102nd Easter anniversary. A Welsh woman is on the Titanic, and she spots the iceberg, and she informs her rather cranky English traveling companion about this, to which the cranky English traveling companion says, "Don't be so negative." And the Welsh woman calmly says, "I'm not telling you how I feel about it. I'm telling you that it is there." The Welsh have a gift for realism. We share it uniquely with our Breton cousins in France. We desire so little that we are not concerned materially or physically in the first instance of what reality has to offer. We merely want to see it. Show us something and we'll tell you that it is there. And this means, for example, to put this in the context, if you describe a beautiful woman in England as beautiful, an Englishman will almost invariably say, "Ah, but you're biased." And the Welsh response is, and we have beautiful women and we're used to admiring, they'll say, "No, she's beautiful. And I say she's beautiful very simply because she is." There is no pre-assumption of skepticism, our interpretive framework, our linguistic bias. We just take things as they are. And the Japanese call this sono tori. And the first person who articulated this doctrine for me sits right there. We were in Paris having a classic French meal, and Graham said, "All I want to do is to read a Japanese text faithfully. All." And in the first instance, all I wanted to understand was to understand Japan on Japanese terms. And that's the beginning of this. However, having mentioned the iceberg, I have two. We have the iceberg of the continuing, unending American conflict with the Orient. The United States has been at war with some part of the Orient, almost without interruption since 1941 to this very day. And still, despite all of that, it is not evident to me that the country's elite has any firm grasp of how Orientals, Asians, East Asians, Near Easterners think at all. And the cost of this in manpower and treasure has been tragic. And at the moment, we are facing yet another potential catastrophic confrontation between the United States and a Confucian society called North Korea that could hasten all the horrors of global warming next Monday. And therefore, it's grim. And in response to this suggestion of, I wrote this book before Trump was elected president. I was in California, Mendocino, on the day of the election, and I cannot tell you the sense of dread that mounted as the election results came in. And then there was the other iceberg, June 16th, 2016, when the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union. And for the last 18 months, we have seen the complete, in my mind, disintegration of something I fundamentally believed all my life to be true, that however ignorant Americans were about Asians, the British, the English, knew what government was for and how it worked. And to see this unravel before one's eyes on a daily basis has been the destruction of a long-held, hopeful dogma in my mind. And so this brings us to Graham's question of what are Lenin's question, what is to be done? Now, on the issue of North Korea, we'll talk in a bit, but we'll talk first about the Brexit matter, because oddly enough, given the setting, there's a metaphysical side to this. Metaphysics in this context are basic assumptions about reality. If you have a doctrine like Occam's razor, so important in English philosophy, that the surface is the truest thing, that anything that's complicated, anything with depth, anything that looks like Ireland will escape your understanding because you keep looking for surface truths and there aren't any. And therefore your policy will end up being wrapped around your neck. Or as Fintan O'Toole has written in the Irish Times, the border will be the gap in the logic of the English to which the whole Brexit project may stumble. And it requires a cast of mind. Relatedly, the notion of other people's minds, another important doctrine to analytic philosophy. If you really, really believe in your heart of hearts that the only mind you can understand is your own, because it's the only one you have unique access to, then how much do you give credence to the thoughts of other people? And how real are they? And over again in this dialogue between the Celts and the English, this haunted minority on the fringes of the English life, that we are there and not there, a presence and an absence, something taken strictly for granted, to which you could probably say without fear of contradiction, that anyone who voted for Brexit voted to leave the United Kingdom. Because in my view, the United Kingdom presently constituted cannot survive. So many bad things have been said, too many angry feelings have been aroused, too many people don't want either solution being proposed, let alone the compromise. And therefore, we must consider something that hasn't been considered in these islands since 1922, partition. It is time for two states in the United Kingdom, remain and leave, and we must find a way of negotiating it. I think it can be done, and I've just finished a book about how this can be done. But at heart of heart, it goes back to a very famous Frenchman, 19th century, another 19th century writer, Ernest Renan, who said that patriotism, nationality, is a daily plebiscite. Each day we get up in the morning, regardless of what happened the day before, and decide to be Irish or French or British. And if you cease to do that, no matter what your past was, no matter what your sentimental connections to each other in the community you have shared and bled with, if there is no belief in that tomorrow, there is no tomorrow together. And at heart, the British are coming to the point, certainly for the Celts and certainly for London, certainly for the great university cities of Great Britain, that we do not want to share a country with people who despise us. And therefore, this dance cannot go on. And therefore, we must think again. In other words, we are two countries pretending to be one. And if this was not enough, if you could travel across the United States, one's reminded daily on that basis. Is the United States two countries, blue state, red state, pretending to be one? To contemplate partition in this way is to make people think again what sacrifices they will make to stay together. If we're not going to make the sacrifices to stay together, we will not stay together. We should not stay together. And in that sense, that urgency, that failure in London, the fact that we can no longer rely upon the English majority to do the right thing, means perhaps it's time for us to sail on our own flag, somewhere else. Together, I prefer, inside the European Union together, together with the Remain England, definitely, to help pay the bills if nothing else. But this moment of needing to do something now has arrived for us. And that's why, when I came out on Easter Sunday and went by the cenotaph and saw the anniversary of the Easter uprising, I thought, whatever it meant then and whatever it meant now, that's where this started. This rethink of what it is to be part of this larger entity that's not working very well. So that's one thing that has haunted me. But behind that is this notion of what is reality? What does it mean to be a country? It's a beautiful thing, the marvelous text of the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Treaty, was that any citizen of Northern Ireland could be British or Irish or both. And that flexibility, that invention of post rigid 19th century nationalism in terms of something that's fluid, that's plural, that accommodates everything I want to be and everything you want to be is the future. And it is, to my view, the most important Irish invention since St. Brendan took to the seas and invented the whole European concept of adventure, travel, infinite quest. And in that sense, I think it's a proud moment. Unexpectedly proud of that breakthrough. If you wanted to deal with the problem of Spain, if you wanted to deal with the problem perhaps even of Syria, of the Chinese borders, what better than the plural definition of national identity? The border doesn't disappear, it just becomes softer, slightly submerged, and therefore less something to bleed over and more something to drive your commerce over or your travel over. I had a wonderful moment with a woman friend of mine, a Welsh woman, a Brexiteer, who had just crossed over from Kent in her van. She said, I'm never going to do that again. I said, Aileen, why? I said, well, there might have been an immigrant in the boot of the car. And I said, well, is that likely? Well, no, but I could have been arrested and I'll never go again. And I said to her, but really, Aileen, think about how any gay man would respond to that. She said, well, how would he respond? I said, well, he would have opened the boot, looked down, and said, is he cute? I mean, this whole notion that this is not another human being is tragic and absurd. It really is. The best moment of something I talked about at dinner last night, and I'll stop on the Brexit thing, was I spent a lot of time in Sicily. And near Ragusa, there's a marina. And when the Libyans came across and the ship started going down, the Sicilians waded out into the sea to drag them in. And they erected a cross, not very far away, as a symbol of welcome. And the head of the British Museum borrowed the cross and parked it in the lobby for a while. He said to remind the English what it is like to be human. And I thought, yes, good for old London. And I think this whole notion, the beauty of it, I've talked with Graham about this, not since the English Civil War has the world of the political philosophy become so important to how we consider ourselves as now. It is a completely liquid, amazing, exhausting, exhilarating intellectual experience. And so spaces like this, where quiet contemplation, listening to one another, is possible still, even now, imagine, become vital to the society. So this institution here, in this place, is uniquely valuable. And the fact that you are here is a measure of that value. And why I think if we're going to make any progress at all in building our community, rebuilding our community, it will begin here with us, listening to one another, arguing, discussing, thinking, moving each other with our words in that magic. So that's that. Korea. This goes back to the discussion my eminent friend here had, and that is, how can we avoid a full-blooded nuclear exchange between North Korea and the United States? What formula of words or ideas would allow us to get beyond that? Because having gone through the Cuban Missile Crisis, some of you old enough, maybe no one's here old enough, 1962, to wince at that, the grocery stores were empty, the churches were packed. You couldn't get a seat in St. Anthony's, where we went, just because everyone was afraid that the end had arrived. And when when détente began to take serious hold, and then the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that disappeared, it was almost impossible to tell younger people how it felt to live daily with the possibility of nuclear annihilation. And then all of a sudden, in an inspired act of reactionary silliness, we returned to that moment, having thought we escaped it. Fukushima Fukushima, that was eye-watering. If you know, perhaps the embassy people will know, that the alert went out, certainly to the British embassy in London, in Tokyo, as far as I know, that this city would have been evacuated if things had gotten any further out of hand. Do you know how many people live within 100 kilometers? 50 million people. Evacuated if the spread of the radiation had been out. And that was a peacetime accident. So the idea that we would, you know, start throwing this stuff at each other is unthinkable, and therefore, what to do? And one of the questions that goes back to is, what is this about? What, I mean, as I always say, let's reverse the logic and say, how would we want the thing to end? If we survived all the dangers and temptations to be brutal with each other, and if the war could be contained in some way, if we agreed to not do option, neither side agreed to not to use the nuclear option and just fight conventionally, what would we want? And in confusion terms, what we would want is very, very clear. We would want a regime change in Pyongyang. And they would want a regime change in Washington. Now, for Americans, the idea that the people and the regime are somehow separable, any good Confucian says, of course they're separable. They're different things. Americans are difficult. Lincoln cursed us in that respect with for, by, and of the people. We need to make a distinction between America that would survive the war and the Trump administration that might not. Or conversely, the North Korean equivalents. Far more serious, of course, is the relationship with the People's Republic. 1941, the United States went to war, projected its power to the very edge of East Asia. I mean the very edge. By the end of the first year of the Korean War, there were American troops on the Yalu River looking into Manchuria. Now, defensively, the only way the United States can secure its position in the old way is to do the same. Defeat North Korea and put American troops on the Yalu River so that Manchuria is a hostage. Taiwan, their Taiwan, our Manchuria. You see how difficult all this becomes. But we need to think through what we want and what we are prepared to do to gain a peace that will last. And that's going to be very, very difficult. And again, oddly enough, as just as the Vietnam War was lost in armchairs, this war will be won and lost in armchairs. The thoughts we think here together about what to do and how to do it, what the Japanese or the Chinese or the Koreans are really about, what motivates them, what is the expression, hearts and minds, then we have to know. And again, only in the quiet of a room like this is it possible to get something called depth. Again, no Occam's razor, please. Depth, complication, true motive, a willingness to peel away our assertions, our assumptions, and say, ah, sono tori, that's it. We need the equivalent clearance of mind to allow us to look at reality as it is. Now, as it is, that doctrine is not a Confucian doctrine. And nor is it a Christian, and nor is it a liberal doctrine. But it is a good old European scientific doctrine. We borrowed from the natural sciences and human sciences, and we thought we'd come up with some idea of what objectivity looks like, what it smells like, what it tastes like. And I think in this circumstance, to sit together and sort out these things, to peel away uncomfortably sometimes our assumptions, is the most splendid thing a human being is capable of. Is that self-examination. Again, Ernest Renan called it the philosophic examination of conscience. You look at a problem, you say, the one thing you are not allowed to do when you see something new, fresh, important, is to allow any of your preconceptions to intrude, at least for a minute. That's what you are obliged to do. And in that strength of that momentary clarity, which for reasons I cannot explain, the Welsh appear to have a gift for. We want to share that gift with all of you and to deepen it and to make our small contribution as a small country, even smaller than Denmark, to making this planet worthwhile, a decent place to live that will survive tomorrow. And Graham's worries are well-founded, but I think we can do it. But I am struck now with the apparent closing simultaneously of the English and American mind, or parts of it, that we are left with our minds. And it's the hour of Celtic fresh thinking about all of these problems, Scottish, Northern Irish included, Irish, of course, Welsh for the first time in a long time, not since perhaps David Lloyd George, have we managed to say anything that carries across the water. And it's time. And I think it's not a bad place to be. For after so many centuries of letting other people do our heavy lifting for us, it's time. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
petition anyone?
I thought the Welsh voted for Brexit.
No, yeah. That's good. The good. We're two countries pretending to be one.
Okay.
The thing that Cardiff voted overwhelmingly, I mean 60-64% to leave, to stay. And my relations in Pontypridd, you have relations in laws?
No,
but I mean, you have the phenomenon of relations. We go up there, I mean, it's short of fisticuffs, really, because so many of them voted to leave, and I can't understand it. But the way I bring it, the conversation to a halt for those folk, my relations, is to tell them a story. You know, Wales to tell stories like Ireland, isn't it? The best thing to doing anything is telling a story. And I was being driven by a taxi cab driver who told the story to Graham, to Heathrow. It was one of those, the plane will put on a chauffeur if you pay enough. And he was a home counties, Cockney. And he'd never been to Wales. And he was friendly enough. And I've been in England long enough to, something you'll understand, the strange getting at people. It's sort of a national sport, which I've never really understood. I always thought it was bad manners, but there we are. So we're about halfway along the M4, and the traffic does build up, and things really ground to a halt. So this rather large man put his arm on the seat and looked back at me, and I thought, whoa, here we go. And he said, tell me now, why should the English taxpayer pay £30 billion a year to Wales? I let the question hang. The question is so poisonous, so taboo. It's like asking what the nature of the frontier is between Wales and England. How dare he? But he asked it. And I thought, ah, something just died. If you really think that, if the English are cranky enough to wake up some morning in a bad mood and to say, we'll cut them off at the knees, that's my definition of a hostage state. Literally completely dependent. I mean, Northern Ireland's dependence on English taxpayer is so overwhelming it's barely worth thinking about. We can't have this. But if they want it, they can have it. But the rest of the M4, south of the M4, where the GMP is, we are going to sail our own way. We are prosperous. We are confident. We are egalitarian. We are mixed. One quarter of our population is English. We are part of the modern world. We have a link to London that we exploit mercilessly, much like the huge Irish community in London does. To make a life for ourselves, this is not a matter of elites. This is a matter of ordinary people picking up their socks and making something of it, without elbows akimbo all the time. And I think that capitalism with a smiling face is what we practice. We care about each other in an urban complex, Cardiff Bay, you know, the London joke about people who say good morning to you and terrifies them is something we find impossible to understand. In Cardiff Bay, you say good morning to anyone. It may be Bodhida, it may be good morning, but we say it. And it's returned. And it's class indifferent. And it doesn't matter what color you are. You're one of us. If you choose to live in Cardiff with us, you are one of us. And the idea that we, you know, roll up trucks with migrant control written on them and transport you to Heathrow to send you back, all 3.4 million, is unthinkable. And so anybody who thinks it, including our beloved Prime Minister, is not going to happen. We will resist. We're not going to have our communities torn apart for this dream, this strange dream that a minority, in my view, of English people suffer from. Yes?
David, I'm thinking, what reminds me of all of this, you know, I'm thinking this kind of speaking tendencies in some places. As you know, there are different levels of analysis, different layers, right? And what we have here, or what I see that in Spain as well with Catalonia, we can remember Indonesia with the, you know, against the Chinese, we can remember programs. You know, we have sometimes certain small groups, sometimes certain elite groups which decide or they think that is useful for the political aims to unfortunately convince certain masses of angry people to direct their anger against other aims which are not the real ones. And what we have here, I think, unfortunately in the Brexit, is a lot of manipulation of the population who have been suffering a terrible situation of economic crisis, of health crisis, all of it, which is now they found an aim to blame. The people are cross, the people are angry, and then suddenly they realize how stupid they've been, some of them, it seems to be. But and it's happening the same in Catalonia, right? There's been a lot of corruption, and there's been masses directed, and so on. So I don't know if really it's two countries. Yeah, I don't know if that division is real. I think a lot of it is portrayed or directed, unfortunately, by fear and manipulation. Because maybe the ordinary people, sometimes they are presented alternative facts, real ones, and they might change their mind. So I really don't know if... the only thing what happens is that it seems like there are not very smart voices out there, reasonable, showing the actual facts of things instead of just a very real swallowing and bringing things very big that are not true, you know.
You are echoing Graham and my frustration with this divide. And the residual belief is that with calm facts, calm voices, trust rebuilt, we can break the divide. And I think the Welsh realist in me says that actually it's like an unhappy marriage. And after a while, you're sitting across each other over the breakfast table and there's nothing to say. And at that point, then it's vastly easier for us to stay and you to go. That's a simple problem, because for the larger part of the country, we're the larger part of the economy. We're exactly where want to be. We want to be part of Europe. Our prosperity is genuine. It's now. It doesn't require, Empire Mark II. We don't believe in any of that. But more interestingly is this, and it goes back to your point about Eton and Oxford. I taught some of these people at Oxford when I lectured. And the arguments that Rees-Mogg or Boris Johnson are making, if they had tried that in an essay with me, the essay would have been thrown on the floor, and they would have been told to do it again. And I think there are a lot of embarrassed masters at Eton thinking, my God, what have we inflicted on our country? Because what they are doing is not what we taught them. They know better, and they're not doing it. And this goes back to Graham's point about, at some point you realize that it's a bunch of grumpy billionaires who want to be more billionaires, who want tax rights off. They want to benefit from lack of restriction, libertarian liberation for them. And the idea that they can exploit nationalist tensions and say the European Union is this or that or the other thing, they aren't using their minds. It isn't a betrayal of the education they had. It is a betrayal, but it has nothing to do with education. They've ignored that because it's politically opportune to make arguments which are simplistic and silly. Eventually, I think they will come unstuck, but I don't propose to wait. If they want to do their, as they say, their kingdom by the North Sea, let them get on with it. But in the meantime, we have lives to lead. And this business, I mean, you imagine if Remain, Britain, as part of the European Union, together with Ireland, sat in dialogue with the Chinese, how successful that might be. We are reasonable people with a reasonable concern for the planet as a whole. But as long as we have these people, these cheerleaders of the devil, sitting next to us say, oh no, can't do that, won't do that, that's dreadful, we'll never get anywhere. And I think the United States, the paralysis of Washington is a consequence of trying to hold something together that isn't going to hold together quite like that. So we need an inspired formula. And guess and behold, the Chinese have it. Hong Kong. No longer a British colony, part of the motherland, but distinct. One country, two systems. The added point was 100 dining opportunities, but we won't talk about that. And I think that is a possibility of the flexibility. And that's a Chinese version of the miracle achieved by the Good Friday Agreement. That's how I see it. It wasn't by choice. It was by, what did St. Thomas call it? Necessity. Necessity has no law. In the face of an opportunity to end how many decades of low-grade vicious violence, the Irish people changed the constitution, rethought again, allowed things to be flexible, thought of a new way of politically identifying themselves and others. And that's an intellectual breakthrough of the first order. If there were Nobel Prizes given for intellectual breakthroughs, that should have been given. And that helped us enormously as example. And that's why it's precious. It isn't the fact that trade is not mentioned in the Good Friday Agreement or not, or which the supervisory bodies handle Northwest versus East-West or any of that. None of that matters in the final instance. It's that notion that on both sides of that border where people are decent-minded, the kind of singular nationalism identity, you're a Brit and you're not, doesn't apply. It's almost French theory, isn't it? It's a triumph. And I think that sense, we are grateful and we want to build on that. And I think it's the future and it's our future and the future we want.
Yeah, I'm confused.
Good.
Is the idea you're suggesting for Britain one in Britain now chooses one, I don't know if it's a real suggestion you're making, I could be wrong about what I'm suggesting that you are suggesting, or whether what you're suggesting is real, or just a kind of a thing to throw out we can talk about, but are you suggesting that people in Britain now choose to be, like in Northern Ireland, they say, okay, I'm a European, and I live next door to a person who opts to be purely UK, is that the idea? And that you have this dual citizenship now, where you, for example, might choose to be UK and European, whereas your neighbour decides to be only UK?
No. It's more brutal than that.
Okay.
It's remain areas. Constituents who voted to remain are remain. And leave areas are leave. That means the people who leave will, if you truly wanted to purge your European population from the country, all your foreigners, you could in the leave areas. That would be left to them. And they could all come to remain, because we'll cheerfully hire them. But the point is this. Those are not returning to the vote issue. No more referendums. We accept the decision made once. If people change their minds later, that's up to them. It's mainly saying, I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not here to argue with you. I'm here to help you pack your bags.
So
you have
the West Berlin.
Yeah.
Berlin is an interesting example because
politicians are dreadful. Remember India and
Poland depends.
Is dreadful because it splits communities. In Spain is happening with Catalonia, and you can only get to a good agreement when people are ready to agree and negotiate. Oh. There are people now in so many in the British government. They don't want to negotiate. They are just making things more and more difficult, and they are just plain a stupid game.
Yes, but listen to me when I talk like you.
Yeah.
We're angry, and we think if we can bring the right arguments along, they'll change their mind.
They won't
change their mind.
I don't think they will.
And therefore, it isn't a question of whether the partition will work or not. It's we have to deal with the division, and then we build on it. It's vastly easier for the leave England, to leave United Kingdom, than to leave Europe.
Yeah.
Vastly easier. We'll stay. We will be the successor state. We will be the members of the European Union. We will carry on all the treaty obligations. We will look after the colonies. Gibraltar will not be a problem. The border with Northern Ireland as a problem will disappear. Why? Because both sides are still in the European Union.
Yeah, except you have a border around, Holyhead or somewhere.
No.
But
those areas, you must realize that leave probably amounts to only one third of the UK economy. The money, the talent, the wealth, the energy, the youth, the thinness, the healthiness are all concentrated in remain areas. We are the future. We're the present. And we want to do this.
So make Sunderland into a...
Sunderland must decide it's a technical thing, and I've dealt with the technical issues of logistics chains. But in the first instance, the only way you can do anything in the world is to want to. They don't want to stick with us, and we don't want to stick with them. But we've cheerfully helped them go their own way. And I think in their grumpled sense, they might say, well, at least we're getting what we want. And sometimes with an Englishman, that works. So we'll get our way, and they'll get their way, and vastly easier than the Brussels Commission. Sir?
Mine was much simpler.
Okay.
When you ended, there was a short lull. It was, I thought, exquisite, because you had already referred to it when you were talking about metaphysics and reality, and you know, you got pretty deeply philosophical.
Oh dear.
And I just want to, in case anyone missed it, to point out how important that seems to be. When you said, when you're confronted with something different, something new, your obligation is to hold back, to suspend judgment, to drop your prejudices. We were just talking about this at the coffee break, because that is now almost never done, because as soon as I hear it, I can tweet it, or tweet against it, or whatever, and nobody is very few people are thinking, the people that are tweeting aren't usually thinking. Mm. And that somehow the culture has accepted this as normal, it's almost, I mean, to ask people to stop and reflect, and further to be a moment or two of reflection, not only for oneself, but as a group, is, I know you get some people asking people to perform unnatural acts, but we ought to try to renaturalize it. I think
all the concerns you raised, Graham, about the need to act now about the ecological problem are, we're never going to be able to act any time unless we have some reduction of that list of impossible demands on the desk of the Prime Minister and the President. I mean, Theresa May's, the things she's trying to do, with the best of intentions, and I don't think she has the best of intentions, are just phenomenal. I mean, 40-some years of European legislation have to be rewritten. You know what that looks like? All of that could be put aside in an instant if we both agree this most remarkable thing, that the Remainers will get what they want and the Leavers will get what they want. I mean, it's brilliant in a way, because it all of a sudden rewards everybody to do, you know, what they want. And, you know, nothing like giving an Englishman what he wants. And I say that, I don't mean to be cynical, but to be a small part of that enterprise and to have it count for so little after so long is heartrending. I mean, don't we matter at all? Our interests, our proclivities, our national identities, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales. I mean, the amount of the public surveys on the amount, a number of English voters who would change their mind over the Northern Irish border, what is it, 15%? If you don't care, you don't keep it. And so eventually we're going to have that splendid, horrifying moment when the abused wife takes over the house, the husband moves out, and she sits down with a cup of tea and say, thank God, because now we can get on with making our lives and building a country. And I think we'll have any trouble whatever doing those things. But for the dialogue with China, we can do business together with the Chinese. And Putin, but with the Chinese, I think it's possible. But we have to have our house in order, and we're never going to get our house in order unless we remove the troublemakers. Let them free. Let them go what they want to do. But the politics of contempt, which has been endemic, I don't know if you... the treatment of the Taoiseach by the tabloid press in Britain was, quite frankly, unspeakable. There was no reason whatever to say the things that were said. And on social media, it wasn't even quotable. It was bilious. And, sorry, you must choose Brexit or the United Kingdom. We don't want the United Kingdom, then we'll make our own arrangements. Or change your mind. But I don't think changing minds. I think you're right, changing minds not possible. But anyway, those are the things that political philosophy, students of political culture, we bring to this. We're strange beasts like hermits in the desert. But occasionally something happens and we realize that maybe this would be useful. And in that sense, we are your servants. We are here to help you think through our problems collectively and doing our damnedest to come up with answers that work. At the moment, the answers aren't working. And therefore, we must dig deeper, as they used to say, for victory. Ken?
Just this technicality about how... So you're saying that the areas that basically had, you know, Remain or Leave majorities in 2016, they can go whichever way the majority there preferred. So you'll get a bit of a patchwork sovereignty adjustment. And that makes me think of, I mean, do you know about the partition of Schleswig in 1920?
I wondered about that.
Yes, which was, to my knowledge, it's the first and I think so far only time that territorial partition has been done democratically. Mm-hmm. The voters were asked, do you want to be Danish or German? And the border, I mean, that's worked very well. There were a few pockets, you know, a few towns on the German side, the Danish majority, and a few German towns on the Danish side. But it worked. Mm. They were asked, and then, of course, if you'd asked the same question, which I think very wisely, Hitler was wiser. Sometimes nobody did in 1940. Then they would have moved north again, and if they'd asked in 1945, Hamburg would have become Danish. Mm. But I mean,
But I mean, you notice the brilliance here. What I'm talking about is a retro, in between kind of solution between the barriers, as you pointed out, because of the rigidity of the identities on both sides of the referendum frontier. But the beauty of the Irish solution was, at some point, it won't matter. That border between Denmark and Germany, because it becomes porous.
Yes.
And I mean, I had a German scholar who looked after me when I was in Berlin, and they were East Prussian refugees, and the Poles had expelled them en masse. I mean, millions of them came to Germany, and I think some of the older members of the family were still bitter. But when Poland joined the European Union, Helmut said, well, if I really, really want to have a house there outside the Soviet zone, I can do it. And the fact that the border is there but means less is just an astonishing thing to be able to do. And that the multiple identities confirms that. And therefore, you could be German and Danish depending on what you were having for breakfast that morning. I don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's certainly not worth killing someone over, I think. And that potential, I think, will ease from the partition when people look at the consequences of their decisions, the Irish, the Welsh majority. Who's going to pay the bills? Are they going to have a Welsh awakening and all of a sudden decide that maybe it's time for bootstraps and pulling up our socks and getting on with making a Wales that works? For south of the M4 in Cardiff, Wales works. For the first time since the collapse of coal, that city pays its way. And it's tremendous. I mean, there's nothing like prosperity to encourage optimism. The Welsh are not an optimistic people. They become. I remember when I first arrived, because being in California, I'm hopelessly vulnerable to sunshine, like you are. And I would go into the university, and the sun was shining. And I would say, oh, it's beautiful today. And then the Welsh response, oh, it won't be nice tomorrow. And with global warming, in the meantime, it's quite cheerful because the weather in Cardiff Bay and the whole English, mainly Cardiff Bay, because we have a microclimate, is better than ever. We have more and more days. So the person who says to me, well, it won't be nice tomorrow, is usually wrong. It will be nice tomorrow. But mainly it's, I mean, the Welsh adore children, and our symbol in Cardiff Bay, we have an opera house, and the symbol of the city is a tricycle, a kid's tricycle parked up against, because we're so committed. I mean, it's like living in the Mediterranean. Everywhere you look, there are young families on the property ladder with kids. They're staying married because they can make a decent life. I think that's hard to do in London, but we know how to do it in Cardiff. We're less prosperous, but the quality of life is infinitely higher because you have time for a chat. And that's really important. And it's almost a national religion. And they don't drink as much, but we talk a lot. But it's good. It's very, very good. It has nothing to do with elitism. Nothing to do. These are ordinary people making successful, ordinary lives in a city that's optimistic and full of buzz, which is diverse. So you come up with this notion of almost protected diversity. We want our mixed communities. We want our Greek coffee merchants and our Turkish-speaking Kurdish grocery store owners, and we want the English person who makes some, you know, amazing shop in the city, and it's all part of it, isn't it? That's it. Look at Dublin. Look at the dynamism here, the prosperity of this. Look at the future writ in Irish. That has to be a good thing. I must say it was astonishing to come to the airport. Gaelic written everywhere. It was like being back in Cardiff. A different language, but I mean, the fact that the language symbolism, in Wales it's even more serious for obvious reasons, because so many people speak, but it's part of it. But if you don't, it doesn't matter. It's not a snobbery. It's a gesture of solidarity in how we pronounce things and all kinds of stuff. It's good.
Yes? I have a question for you. Oh.
Not him. Not him.
I saw a comment in the book. I think I saw some Chinese character.
Yes, Chinese characters. Just for you.
Yeah. So heavenly command is never constant. Right?
Exactly.
It's no, changing.
No regime lasts forever.
Yeah, that's actually very Chinese. A book of changes, the oldest.
It is? Well, this is curious. I thought it was. But this is 13th century. This is Song Dynasty usage. And I think the Mongols embraced it. Because as they ground down the Song, they kept reminding them.
Yeah, but there is a pair. So all the Chinese phrases always come like yin and yang. So the pair, the second one is only virtue would be able to be the assistant, wei de shi fu, which means come back to Confucian thesis.
Mm.
Even when the heavenly command is changeable, still being virtuous and being the kind of Confucian ideal ruler will help you to hold this heavenly command.
Once you've got it.
Once you've got, so you mean, however we want to be virtuous, we have to choose the bloody way to get.
No, no. The bloody way is the only way. But once you've got it, the only way to keep ruling is to have virtue. You cannot rule with bloody slaughter. That's not possible.
Yeah, I understand.
That's where the Confucian came back.
Yeah.
The Han deal. Yeah.
It has to start with the very ugly beginning.
It doesn't have to, but it always does.
I believe Machiavelli writes this in Prince as well. He was, of course, referencing his experience of observing a Cesare Borgia, who he observed in action. Mm-hmm. But really, this is what he says, is that when you seize power in an area, you very well probably will have to do some bloody slaughter, but that has to be constrained to a short initial period, and then once that's over, it has to be over totally.
Anyway, it was a pleasure.
Sorry,
no, the embassy is always welcome.
Thank you.
No, this is one book. I'm doing a book on Brexit. The next book's on Machiavelli. And he's the one Westerner, more than Aristotle, Plato, although I thought I enjoyed that enormously. But Machiavelli did something that no Western thinker of his prestige did. And that's where he contemplated an alternative reality. He was raised in Catholic, rumpy-pumpy, semi-pagan Renaissance Italy and said, look at the regime of the ancient Romans and the Greeks was better. And therefore, Christianity as a form of, as a foundation for the polity is not good enough. And he went to the very edge. And by borrowing from Old Testament figures, there's almost an Oriental element. But, I mean, if Machiavelli had ever got to China, he might have had a different thought. Because all of a sudden you have a very remarkable, working, robust, occasionally extremely violent, but nevertheless robust, humane system. I mean, and he would have been dumbfounded. And it would have been outside the European orbit. And that's why Machiavelli takes us to the very door without opening it. And that's why I think the Orientalists, his successors, have opened the door. And you've got your hand on the handle.
if we have time, I'd ask one more question if I can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry to harping on about it a bit, but about on the Brexit again. Like, if you create these enclaves for a start, first of all, depending on the area that you choose, the bad news is that you could well be in the part that decided to be outside Europe. You know what I mean? Like, second thing is that the Irish. Northern Ireland Irish solution won't be available, because the whole idea is that the people inside those enclaves will by definition reject it. And the third thing is a separate question, separate issue, to say that part and parcel of modern, well, not even modern, since Hobbes,
politics is finding a way to live alongside people you really don't agree with. You know, you totally disagree with them fundamentally, and you still have to deal with them. You know?
Yes. Now, that's all. First of all, metaphysically, before you raise any objection to this, you must decide what you want. And once you want, then these become technical problems. But if empirical objections are made to the metaphysical assumption, then you've got confusion here that it's almost impossible to solve. You're saying, I want it, but I can't have it because there's some technical problem. Mm-hmm. And actually, the essence of the Welsh approach is to say, firmly, you know, think calmly, what is it exactly that you want? And then we proceed to the technical solution. For example, the idea that Newcastle, which voted to stay, let's Sunderland. Sunderland voted to leave. Okay. Now, we have Boris Johnson talking about what we'll have. We'll have Brazilian entrepreneurs coming in. And they will invest. And it'll be wonderful because they have this new trade deal with Brazil. What happens? The first time, that Brazilian entrepreneur's wife is abused in the streets for not being pale. What happens the first time her child in school gets his head dunked in a loo because he's Brazilian? Now, you notice that the enforcement of social mores goes from top to bottom. Boris Johnson cannot save that child. And in essence, the Brexit approach to the trade deal is we want all the advantages of free trade without the people coming in. If we can do it by revolt, if the Brazilians can stay in Brazil, great. You see how unworkable it is. People who believe that have to live with the consequences of that. They may want it. They must decide, for example, will I sell or give a bottle of water to some foreigner who happens to be passing through for whatever reason, or not? Will my community enforce those social mores? You have to have a community consensus from top to bottom about what you want to do with outsiders. I mean, when Brexit happened, we had people, you know, Welsh people, being denounced in the streets of England for speaking Welsh. We had Scots being told, wear your kilt at home. Those are white people. Those are white British people. You see what, and those, that's a community decision that they must decide. We don't have that problem.
Who's we?
We, the Remainers.
But you will be in one of those Exeter's areas after they make the border.
We're not voting, but again, you're thinking of national categories.
I know,
but we're not doing national categories.
Draw a border somewhere.
No, the borders are the constituencies that voted one way or the other.
What's a constituency?
Constituencies are parliamentary, are seats,
yeah.
Are towns that voted collectively, that think of themselves as a unity. And if the local population will accept it, they will accept it. If they're willing to impose it on all of us, they'll certainly impose it on their neighborhood. Now, the mechanics of it, another matter, how to do it. But fundamentally, the thought experiment is to make you understand. Now, a personal story. I applied for British nationality in Japan under Tony Blair's liberalization. And I was turned down. And my passport was stamped.
I'm sorry.
So I flew back from Paris into Bristol, and I was arrested. They took me aside and held me for an hour incommunicado and didn't allow me to contact anyone while they investigated my situation. Now, I happened to be the expert on police, and therefore I knew all about these. Anyway, this went on. That wasn't the fun part. The fun part is I got in a cab in London, a Jamaican, and I told him the story, and he laughed. And he said, it's not funny. He said, oh, it's hysterical. You have no idea how funny this is. And he said, why? He says, I thought that only happened to black people. Now, if you'd lived in England long enough as a colonial, you know it has nothing to do with race at every level. It has everything to do with being degrees of being English. And colonials are not English. When I was at Oxford, I was treated as colonial. Patronized regularly. Teased regularly. It was part of the game. Now, I so wanted to be at Oxford that I put up with it. But I'm a native speaker from a good colony, the biggest of them all. And still, they were treated like this by people of superb education. This, and I just put up with it. And I'm not willing to put up with it anymore. And that's part of the reason. And I think in Wales, in the parts I'm talking about, we're running out of options. We're really running out of options. Too many businesses are too insecure because the Theresa May's government cannot decide on what they want. And even if they can decide, they're not going to get it. But in the meantime, we're all hung out to dry. We have to do something. And if pushing partition makes them say, stop and think, maybe compromise sensibly, we can buy some time. But the problem ain't going to go away. If you really think that Englishmen, non-Englishmen are your inferiors, it's going to show. It's not pleasant. It's not necessary. And in London, it doesn't happen in my experience. But it does happen in Great Yarmouth, which voted 75% to leave.
Oxford voted to stay.
Of course they did. Every university city but Durham voted to stay.
But in Oxford, you were getting the abuse.
Well, in Oxford, that was this version of it. They weren't asking to send me home. They were just humiliating me ritually. It's not the same thing. I mean, you went through passport control. You went into Heathrow with a Oxford, you know, university go sign. I was given the third degree. Oh, why are you coming? How long are you going to stay? When are you going to home? I did my research in the Home Office. I knew about these people. That's a cultural thing. Ritual humiliation of minorities. You may understand.
I know.
So anyway, that's the point. But I think, as I said, the essence of the only contribution the Welsh can make is to say, that's it, and I want it. And everything else is a technical question, metaphysics or otherwise. There we go.
Thank you very much. Okay. I think just very unceremoniously, I think it's been a very good afternoon.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it. And yes.
And thank you.
Thank you.